Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. How are you guys doing? Good morning. Okay, good morning, everybody. It's Friday. Yay. So, let's hope for just some extra sleep. How about that? These days you just have to measure what you get, you know. Can't ask for too much because you're just gonna get disappointed. Okay, so maybe some extra sleep. Go to bed early a couple of nights. Okay, so I picked out some what I think are podcasts that you will find interesting, that maybe it's something that you never knew about, and you're going to be glad that you heard this news. So I wanted to give you guys something upbeat for the weekend. Okay, and she's pretty upbeat, I'll tell you that much. Her name is Dr. Vandana Shiva. And basically, she is after Bill Gates in a big way. So here we go. Second. Okay. She's going all across the country with this message, and she's getting a standing ovation. I knew of her from India. I heard about her when she was in India. Now I'm screaming. Okay, it's just cycling a little bit. But the first time I heard her, she was, her explanation and her information was so right on.
From my region in the Himalaya called Uttarakhand, and the Himalaya, which we are working on making fully organic, to an organic Vermont, my love and my greetings. It's good to be back here. You know, every time I come to this country, I realize that Vermont really is the most advanced state. When it comes to serious issues of life.
Yes.
There's serious. A part of this country that sinks deeper into a black hole. And I don't have to tell you where that is.
New York, San Francisco.
Of course, fake news is the favorite word in the discourse these days. But you know, the really fake news has been around for more than 50 to 60 years. And that fake news is industrial agriculture, large-scale agriculture, monocultures, chemicals, GMOs, corporations feed the world. That was fake news the day it started. And it's continued. Sadly, because governments and corporations join hands to say that it was the corporations that came out of the war that would take control of our food system. And it's a system that I say is based on, of course, on the mechanical mind, and that's the real border I'd like to cross. The boundaries of the mechanical mind, which pretends that we are separate from nature, which pretends that nature is just dead matter. Soil is just a container for pouring nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium into. The plants are just a machine for guzzling up fossil fuels and urea. Now that mechanical mind has got us into deep problems. But it has, of course, generated the extractive economy where profits lie, and there are big leaps being made on how to turn every crisis of that system into a new market opportunity. It is by necessity a monoculture paradigm. I've called it the monoculture of the mind. Because when you design something on external inputs, and you know, mechanical systems have to be organized externally. Living systems evolve through self-organization. And two amazing scientists from Chile, Maturana and Varela, distinguish between autopoietic systems, systems that self-organize and make themselves. And in that, I would include not just the organisms, I would include communities. And Gandhi talked about this as Swaraj, as self-rule, the deepest democracy. So every time you feel bad that that sinkhole a little south of you is sinking, just realize that the real democracy grows from the ground up, as I've written in my book, Earth Democracy. And it never was the power or sanity of one man. So don't feel too sad. It is by necessity a system that must lead to higher and higher concentration, and therefore tends towards monopoly. And of course, not only do you get monopoly from concentration, you get monopoly from artificial illusions that corporations like Monsanto invent the seed, that they are creators of seed. That's why they can take a patent. That's why they can collect royalties. And the suicides that Will mentioned are really a result of the fact that Monsanto was illegally, because I worked in my country to make sure there were no patents on seed, there were no patents on life. Our patent law, Article 3J, says plants and animals are not inventions.
Right.
And yet Monsanto was collecting royalties. And we have about 5 court cases right now where they're still claiming they have a right to collect royalties. Mm. And our antitrust commission, our government, and our movements are saying, sorry, you did it illegally. You entered illegally. You've continued collecting royalties illegally. You remember, Will, when you were with us in Vidarbha, I'd got this bottle of Roundup, and I said, why on earth are they selling Roundup? We've just caught them pushing Roundup-ready cotton illegally. So there's a monopoly created by these fake property rights to invention of seed and of life. And this is where prices of seed jumped 80,000%. The seed failed frequently because it was not meant for dry areas, drought areas. It needed pesticides because the BT does not succeed as a technology of pest control, nor does Roundup Ready technology succeed for weed control. I don't have to tell you that. So here are failed technologies that are being sold again and again and again to trap farmers in debt. In the US, my calculation is these intellectual property rights to seed is getting Monsanto $10 billion annually for corn and soil. And they knew strategies for monopoly, which I will address a little later. But it must go hand in hand with militarism. After all, these technologies came from war. They are instruments of killing. Will's book, The war on bugs gives us the history of where pesticides came from, the concentration camps, the poison gases. Even the chemical fertilizers came out of the explosive factories and ammunition factories, the same method of artificially fixing nitrogen by burning fossil fuels is the root of both ammunition and bombs, as well as synthetic fertilizer, which is why you get fertilizer bombs turning up everywhere. Herbicides, Agent Orange, Vietnam War, all of this came out of a militarized mind where everything was an enemy. The insects are your enemy. Every plant is an enemy. That's why you must kill them with herbicides. And small farmers are your enemy. And I believe small farmers are seen as an enemy because a system that is so violent in its thought and its implementation is a deeply afraid system. I mean, if you use that kind of power, you are afraid. And it's through my work over the decades on ecofeminism, I realized that this concentration of violence in capitalist patriarchy comes from the fear of everything that's alive and free. Every small farmer is alive and free. That is the significance of the small farmer. But of course, there's other significances. Small farmers produce more. We had a prime minister who was distantly related to my mother, Chaudhary Charan Singh. And this is what he wrote. Agriculture being a life process, in actual practice, under given conditions, yields per acre decline as the size of the farm increases. In other words, as the application of human labor and supervision per acre decreases. The above results are well nigh universal. Output per acre of investment is higher on small farms than on larger farms. Thus, if a crowded, capital-scarce country like India has a choice between a single 100-acre farm and 40 2.5-acre farms, the capital cost to the national economy will be less if the country chooses the small farms. Now, I got involved in agriculture not because that was my choice, but because our country in 1984 was just erupting in all kinds of violent expression of this violent system. The Bhopal disaster, where the gas leaked in Union Carbide's pesticide plant, killed up to 7,000 people in one night. Mm-hmm. People are still dying. Children are being born maimed. Mm-hmm. The Bhopal tragedy continues. Or Punjab, where the so-called Green Revolution, which I've said was not green, was not revolutionary, was just an extension of chemical warfare. Mm-hmm. Now to the third world in the name of feeding the world. Punjab, the most fertile land, the proudest farmers, today is a ruined land. The soils are dead, the rivers are dying. There's a train that leaves Punjab called the cancer train because it carries people who are victims of cancer because of heavy pesticide use. 75% of the youth are drug addicts. They're having an election right now around this issue of addiction. That's the central theme. In 84, Punjab erupted in violence. It had the Nobel Peace Prize had been given to Norman Borlaug for the Green Revolution. And I said, there's not much peace here, so what went wrong? Interestingly, it was the year 1984. And so I worked on it, and that's how I realized the roots of the system. The violence was not accidental. It was structural. It was systemic. And I also, just from my eyes, could make out our little farms, our terrace farms up in the Himalaya, produce more food than the monocultures of rice and wheat in Punjab. And so I started then, and I've continued since then, to go beyond the measure of yield per acre, which is the measure through which industrial agriculture is promoted every step. Because all that yield per acre measures is the commodity that left the farm. Mm-hmm. So every time you convert a biodiverse farm into a single commodity producing farm, you're going to get more commodities. Mm-hmm. Every time you increase the cost of input, it's not counted. The disappearance of food is not counted. All the pulses and oil seeds, 250 crops Punjab grew, their disappearance is not counted. Today we are importing 70% of our pulses and 70% of our oil seeds. We used to eat, as a species, we depended on 10,000 species of plants. The globally traded commodities are about 8, and only 3 account for most of the calories eaten. So the real fake news is this industrial system that produces commodities is not feeding the world. 90% of the corn and soya in the world is going for biofuel and animal feed. 90%. Only 30% of food people eat comes from industrial farms. 70%, even today, in spite of nearly 70 years of war against small farmers, still comes from small farms. Can you imagine if after a 70-year war, small farmers still account for 70% of the food we eat? How easy it would be to turn it into 100% supply. On the other hand, if we allow the industrial system, which is a warfare system, to increase slightly more, say up to 45%, we'd have a dead planet. Because the 30% supply has already destroyed 75% of the planet. In terms of soil, in terms of biodiversity, it's even more, in terms of water. And 50% of all the greenhouse gases come from an industrial globalized system. So we started to look in Navdanya when I started to save seeds because I just didn't like the idea of a Monsanto controlling all seed and pushing GM seeds and more toxics. I love life, I love biodiversity, I love freedom. And there's nothing that's going to come in my way of defending the freedom of life on earth. So he said, what really matters in food is, oh, where did those things disappear? They were so beautiful. May all be fed, right? May all be fed. We have an ancient Taittiriya Upanishad which says everything is food, everything is something else's food. The food web is the web of life. There's a web of life in the soil. There's a web of life between plants. There's a web of life between insects and plants. There's a web of life in our gut. And that web of life is around food as the nourishment. So we said we're going to measure nutrition per acre, not yield per acre, because measuring the production of nutritionally empty, toxic loaded commodities is not assessing a food system. You know, it's fake. It's a fake food system. Yeah, I think we should thank your president for introducing the word fake, because now we can say fake food, fake seed, fake this, fake that. So measuring nutrition per acre, we found the biodiverse farms that Navdanya members cultivate can have the potential to feed to India's. That's our report, health per acre. We don't measure yield per acre, we measure health per acre. And the health per acre is vital because if food is nourishment, then that's what we should be measuring. Not only because, as Howard said, health is a continuum from the soil to the plants to the animals, including humans. We sometimes forget we are animals. Because if we remembered we are animals, we'd remember we are all human animals. And then we wouldn't get so troubled that among human animals, some have a different color and some have a different religion. At the end of it, we are all one species. We're one humanity. Our animalness is what unites us. Even though it's been used as a metaphor of behaving like an animal, I think we should start behaving like animals now. And in fact, we should start behaving like vegetables. So if you look at the roots of vegetare, you know, the root of vegetable, it means that which is alive. And now when they want to describe someone who is in a coma in a hospital, they say he's in a vegetable state. No, vegetable state is a state of aliveness, of intelligence. In fact, my new book, which I'm calling Resurgence of the Real, actually has a dictionary of terms and how things changed in meaning. You know, the word resource used to mean that which resurges. Now it means raw material. Human resources are you as raw material for the big economy. And you are all people who said, no more, we're going to farm. The soul's health comes from the amazing living beings that populate it and create in it. A gram of soil, 50,000 algae, 400,000 fungi, including the mycorrhizal, teaspoon of living soil, 1 billion bacteria, which would become a ton. Do they measure that in yield per acre? It's missing. And in a square meter, 1,000 earthworms at our farm, as the monsoon comes, I feel so happy. You know, you can't take a step without stepping on about 50 earthworm moles. And Darwin wrote a book. I mean, they took up this survival issue and turned it into competition. But he wrote a book. He actually wrote two books, which is so important for our organic community. One is about the earthworm mold. He says, when human history is written, it'll be recognized that this little earthworm had the most important role to play in the survival of our species. And there's another one on plants, in which he describes the plant root and calls it the brain of the plant. And now they are finding out it's a more complex neuron system than our brain. One plant has more neurological activity going on in its root zone than everything going on in our brain. And at one level, people knew this. But that idea of the soil as dead material, empty container, and the fertility comes from the applied nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium is what has misled us for so long. Now, it's the organisms that create all the nutrients in the soil. And there are studies that are showing that there's 60% more nutrients in organically cultivated food. There's a very big meta-analysis in the British Journal. On our own farm, Navdanya, we've just completed a detailed analysis on the changes over the last two decades. For nitrogen, the organic matter, the organic matter is, and we worked on different cropping systems, so it varies around a whole range according to the crops. But the organic matter has increased 29 to 99%. The nitrogen has gone up 44 to 147%, while in the chemical agriculture, it's gone down 22%. So the more you apply synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, the more you're actually losing nitrogen. Phosphorus is up 63%. Potassium's up 84%, in the chemical down 22%. Zinc, they're talking a lot about zinc deficiencies as if it is inherent to a zone rather than the result of how we treat our soil. 14% increase in zinc and a depletion of 37% in the chemical. In the areas where the BT cotton is growing, our survey is now showing that we had lost 22% beneficial organisms within the first 4 years of planting. And now we've just done an update, 60% of beneficial soil organisms are gone. Of course, there's this t-shirt, which I promised to hold up. Because I think it is in the soil that our future lies. As our Veda says, in this handful of soil is your future. Take care of it. This 4,000 years ago wisdom, 4,000 years ago. In this handful of soil is your future. Take care of it. It will sustain you and provide you with food and clothing and shelter and beauty. Beauty is very much part of it. Destroy it and it will destroy you. Now, all of chemical farming has been an escape from the soil and an arrogance that you can replace it. So when it came to synthetic fertilizers, they talked in that period about bread from air. You know, we don't need the soil anymore. You're going to create bread from air by burning fossil fuels. And every step of the so-called innovation in agriculture is running away from the soil. It stops being agriculture because agriculture means the culture of taking care of the land. And if that is missing, you're not doing agriculture. So small farms, biodiverse farms, not only produce more, they actually grow health. You know, as usual, the elite are very fussy people. And, you know, when they come to Navdanya, they'll, you know, oh, why is the food so expensive? I said, 1 rupee more, 1 rupee. Yeah. And I think, madam, you're wearing earrings worth about 500,000 rupees. And when you fall sick, how much is your basic consultation with the doctor? A minimum of 5,000 rupees. I said, just start looking at the organic farmer as your physician. Now, scientifically, we know that the more biodiverse your diet, the healthier it is. So they celebrate the Mediterranean diet. The West woke up to diversity with the Mediterranean diet. But you know, I love the Italians and I love Italian food, but it still has just about 6 vegetables. You know, in India, our everyday plate will be about 50 plants that we eat. And in Ayurveda, our Ayurveda science says, if you want a balanced diet, you have to have at least 6 tastes in your meals. The sweet, the sour, the salt, the bitter, the pungent, the astringent. Of course, there are all kinds of scientists now working on the fact that they've just woken up 2 years ago that the gut is important. Ayurveda knew that it's a central process. They're calling it the microbiome.
Right, the microbiome.
And of course, finding trillions of organisms that make our body function. But I was reading something by a very brilliant scientist. But I can't figure out why the bitter sensors are there. Well, come and eat Karela. You'll know. So diversity from the soil to the plants, to our plates, to our gut, is a survival mechanism. 75% of all non-communicable chronic diseases are coming from the diet. The combination of the fact that you're loaded with toxics, but also that your food is absolutely incomplete. It is nutritionally empty in a very deep way. And we should just stop talking of commodities as food. Small farms don't produce commodities, they produce food. The large-scale industrial farms produce commodities. We don't need more commodities. The world is drowning in commodities that are lowering the prices of food for the farmer, but increasing the price of food for the poor. I won't go into details of the fact that it's the gut bacteria that actually even manage our brain. That's why they're calling it the second brain. And the fact that we have an explosion of autism, Alzheimer's, all kinds of neurological problems is related to the fact that the food that's being eaten is killing our second brain. So organic farms, small farms, grow health. They grow real wealth. 300,000 farmers of India wouldn't have committed suicide if there wasn't the fake wealth equation being created. So partly because it rhymes, after health per acre, we did wealth per acre. Yeah? And we did two things in wealth per acre. First, we assessed the externalities of chemical farming, and the social and ecological alone is $1.2 trillion a year in India, equal to our GDP. We haven't added the disease burden in this, which would be another 1.5 or 2 trillion. It's externality, but it's also a market opportunity, because the same companies sell you the chemicals that make you sick. Mm-hmm. Then Bayer comes around and has a patented cancer drug. So for them, the more you get sick, the bigger their market. As you know, Monsanto and Bayer have merged, Syngenta and ChemChina are merging, Dow, DuPont have merged, and all the small seed companies have been sucked up by them. But they're reaching for the next level of monopoly. And that's the context in which the relevance of our small farms and organic farming becomes even more important. So 2 years ago, Monsanto bought up the world's biggest climate data corporation. And then very rapidly bought up the world's biggest soil data corporation, renamed it Solem. It also bought up the world's biggest bee research institute because it was becoming clear the chemicals are killing the bees. Mm-hmm. Recently, Monsanto has started to join up with Silicon Valley. They bought up 16 companies there. And David Friedberg, who was the founder of the Climate Corporation, who sold it to Monsanto, is working very closely with Monsanto. And this is the future of agriculture that they see. Everything on the farm is being digitalized. From the atmosphere to the field to the soil, we are ingesting data about what's happening in the atmosphere, the rainfall, temperature, radar data from satellites and weather stations, data from farm machinery about how much fertilizer and pesticides is being sprayed. They call it spyware. How much seed they're putting down and what kind of seed. The farmers. Then drones and remote sensing platforms are looking at electromagnetic radiation light coming off the fields, giving information of crop health, and then there are new ways of observing the soil, picking up constant characteristics of chemical composition. Do they know the billions of bacteria? Does big data mean knowledge? No, it doesn't. You know, big data in a big ocean of ignorance is just more ignorance. And then this David Friedberg goes, by the way, he's kind of, you know, he wants to become famous as an organic farmer with quinoa, and he runs organic restaurants, and then he's doing all this stuff. And one of the things that has been most gratifying for me personally is seeing how we can help Monsanto apply data science to their seeds, on how their seeds are bred and grown. This is important in terms of helping the climate. If you get the seed genetics right, you can grow a plant more efficiently. Now, you're worried about your president? Read this. The whole place is full of adolescents who are playing Lego. Never grew up. You know, we save seeds in Navdanya. We've saved salt-tolerant seeds. We've saved climate-resilient seeds. We've distributed them large-scale after the Orissa supercyclone, after the tsunami, after the droughts, and it has helped farmers bounce back after climate disasters and have resilience before climate disasters. Climate resilience is not a single gene trait. Roundup resistances, BT toxinase, but any complex trait has multiple genes acting together. And these seeds have been evolved by nature and farmers over centuries. All that the Monsantos do is steal them. And then the big data stuff is that they run algorithms. They know this is a salt-tolerant seed. Then they run an algorithm over the hundred, thousands of salt-tolerant seeds. And then as they write, we bet on the, and it's like a lottery. We bet on what will be the winning traits. They're playing lottery with life on this planet. We've seen what financial lottery did with the 2008 collapse. So the combination of big data is ignorance, playing lottery, and control. But can you imagine that their vision of the future is farming without farmers, surveillance technologies everywhere, and only working within the system that has already failed. The MD of the Monsanto's growth ventures, which is the Silicon Valley interface, John Hammer, says, if you think about it, there are two people in the earth that need to know a lot about remote sensing technology, Monsanto and the CIA. Now, Vermont did the amazing work on getting a labeling law, and there was a Mr. Pompeo, how do you say his name?
Pompeo,
who wrote the act that undid it, and now he's going to head your CIA. So do we want agriculture to be part of surveillance or a part of the deepest love that humanity can have for the earth? Are we going to allow our agriculture to be intelligence in terms of spying or intelligence in terms of the expression of life, because life is intelligent. Life is not dead matter. They got it so wrong in the mechanical paradigm. Every cell is intelligent. Every organism is intelligent. Every human being is intelligent. The roots of intelligence, it comes from intellegere. It means to make choices. The bacteria that becomes resistant to antibiotics is expressing its intelligence. The weed that becomes resistant to Roundup is expressing intelligence. And interestingly, a system that came out of exterminating people in the concentration camps is again talking the language of extermination. So one of the problems of Roundup resistance emerging in weeds is the Palmer amaranth. And so Bill Gates and DARPA, which is the Defense Research Institute, put out a study on gene drives, which is the new genetic engineering technology, to push species to extinction. And, you know, one would say, if herbicide tolerance isn't working as a technology, put it aside, work on better weed control technologies that ecological farming has already got established. No, they want to continue with more stacking of more toxic traits, and they want to push the amaranth to extinction through gene drives. And there's a footnote in the study which says, yeah, in India they eat amaranth, there will be a little food security impact. We don't just eat amaranth. Like the Mexicans, amaranth in India is a sacred plant. Amar, forever. The perenniality of life. So on our biodiverse and small farms, we are, of course, growing health. We are growing real wealth. And I would add, we are growing real freedom. It's the only place where humanity will be able to cultivate freedom in these times. You can spend all the money you want to try and reform who will occupy the White House after 4 years. But the true change will come from how we change the way we think about ourselves on this earth, about how we grow our food, how we relate to our other relatives in the earth family, And I really believe that the task before us is to cultivate living seeds, living soil, living food, living economies. So that's what we offer in our one-month course on the A to Z of agroecology and organic food systems. And you'll have cards on your tables, and you can find some more on the, or when you go out. On the Earth University and the courses we offer, as well as now we are starting Earth Journeys. Because I do feel we all need to learn a lot more from the Earth and her biodiversity. And we need to learn a lot more from those who have farmed for 10,000 years. They are amazing systems. Agriculture is not an invention. Agriculture is the ultimate co-evolution of human beings with the Earth. Mm-hmm. It is the expression of the highest level of creativity, a non-violent creativity. Not the violence of the systems that have destroyed so much and will destroy a little more and not find a solution to any of the problems. I would end by saying that, you know, we have to move from the monoculture of the mind to the diversity of the mind. We have to move from the militarized mind to the mind of nonviolence and peace with all creation. And in terms of moving from the monoculture of the mind to diversity, I think it's very, very important that we don't slip into a single function reason for why we do agriculture or why we have organic farming. It's a biodiverse activity. It is a multifunctional activity. At least for me, the first reason I do it, it's the one place where I can return to the earth and say thank you every day. It's the place where we can give back. You can go beyond the border of your head and become one with the earth. We are one with the earth. We need a reminding. And gardening and organic farming helps remind us. We are of the earth. The word human, derived from the word humus. We are human to the extent that we are of the soil. We lose our humanity to the extent we get separated, we get alienated, we become careless. So I know there has been a lot of discussion at this conference on the whole role of organic farming in carbon, in climate change, climate resilience mitigation. But let's not forget the other aspects of why we need an organic future. It's vital for health. It's vital for freedom and democracy. It's vital for being an Earth citizen and practicing Earth democracy. And it's that whole system that is what nourishes us. And it is that system that will give us not just the resilience, but the immunity to deal with the insanity of these higher levels of convergences of violence and monopolies and militarization and fear. The Earth is inviting us to sow the future with her. She's inviting us to sow the seeds of freedom. And I learned from Gandhi. And when I first heard about what the corporations wanted in 1987, you know, I started seed saving in 1987 when you joined NOFA. You know, and I'm thinking in my head, oh my God, they want to have total power over the earth and over all life on earth. And I thought of Gandhi and the spinning wheel. And, you know, the British Empire at that time controlled 85% of the territories of the planet. And Gandhi pulled out the spinning wheel and said, we will spin our way to freedom. And when he was asked, how do you think a few pieces of wood can get you freedom? He said, it's the only thing that can. Because this small spinning wheel can be made in any home, can be spun by the poorest of women. And when the last woman in the poorest hut is part of the freedom movement, that's when India will get her freedom. And so I took inspiration from that, as well as his power to say no to unjust law, the salt. Remember when the British wanted to monopolize salt, he went to the beach and picked up the salt. Right. And said nature gives it for free, we'll make it, and we need it for our survival if we're going to continue to make salt. And we say the same in Navdanya, that nature and our ancestors have given these seeds. We owe it to the future to hand it over in the diversity, integrity, and beauty that we've received the seeds in. And so we will not ever obey a law that comes in our way of the higher duty to Gaia and higher duty to our future. So every time we think, oh, we are small, let's remember Gandhi. That small multiplied millions of times is the large of today. And the largeness of that small is the largeness of solidarity, of compassion, of a planetary consciousness. Exactly the power we need to deal with the brute, violent power of irresponsible bullying. Thank you.
Okay, she, you know, all of her speeches are done just on the top of her head, so this time she was very nice. She didn't say anything nasty about Bill Gates, but all of her speeches get across the meaning, and it's, you can't lose the meaning that we need to take care of our soil, and these people that are taking away our seeds, our generational seeds, are criminal. And so we have to get back to that. And, you know, Bayer bought Monsanto, and now they've got, you know, a huge loss. And I think they're trying to make it up with the their vaccine, so don't take that vaccine, whatever you do. Don't take any vaccine. And there's some coming down the pike. Okay, the next one that I thought that you would find interesting is, there it is. Amir Sephardi. The Illuminati and the One World Government.
Of this morning is the Illuminati and the One World Government, and I betcha that some of you are here because of the name Illuminati. Ah, it's cool. It's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's burning from the fire of hell.
Yes, it is.
You know,
okay, he's spiraling, he's buffering.
Going back to Genesis chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, we find all the answers to all that evil that started then and continues until our very days. God created the heavens and the earth, and he did that within 6 days. And he created us in an intelligent way. We were not monkeys or apes. We did not have to get some sort of evolution. We were already okay, because when God saw us, the Bible said... As he saw that it is good. But then on the last day of the 6 days of creation, because remember the seventh day he rested. On the sixth day he created men, Adam, remember, And then from his ribs came Eve, because it was not good for man to be alone. And knowing man's heart and knowing what might happen, as a good father, the Lord said to Adam and Eve, one thing I ask you not to do. I'm going to give you a garden. I'm going to give you life, health, abundant life. Nothing is going to be wrong here. You're going to have dominion over any animal that is right here and any creature that is in the ocean. Can you imagine? We do this and the lion is coming. Say, go get the deer. Tell it to come right now. Everything is under our control. But then there's one thing he said, don't do. He said, don't eat from the fruit of that tree. Because when you eat it, you will surely die. Surely die. Say that. Surely die. And then the Bible says, then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. For God knows in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. You see, God knows good and evil. That's why he tells you, stay away from evil. But when you don't even go there, there's no place for evil in your world. But when you now know it, isn't that interesting? The minute they ate from that fruit, they immediately were filled with evil. And evil brings you to shame and guilt. And they were hiding. And it's interesting because it's a double lie here. Because first he says, you will surely not die. And then he says, your eyes will be open and you will be like God. This is the birth of the Illuminati. Now, probably you're saying, wait a minute, this is a verse from Genesis. Yes, Illuminati is a Latin word. It's a plural case of a Latin word called Illuminatus, which means the enlightened. To be enlightened means to see the light. It means to get some revelation, to get some knowledge that will open your eyes to see things you couldn't see before, things you didn't know before, things that will make you more clever, things that will make you superior, things that will make you kind of give you more control. And Illuminati means more than one. Guess what? Eve gave it to Adam, and guess what? They were already two. Guess what? They were the first Illuminati. They were the first one who were seeking illumination, who were seeking enlightenment, who were seeking to actually know more. And unfortunately, as that serpent said, to be like God. You know, one of the founders, or excuse me, one of the leaders of the Freemason Illuminati in America, the leader actually, he was the Grand Commander of the Supreme Council. He was a 33-degree Mason. His name was Albert Pike. He actually wrote in his book, Morals and Dogma, Lucifer, the light bearer, strange and mysterious name given to the spirit of darkness. Lucifer, the son of the morning. Is it he who bears the light? Doubt it not. And that's in page 321. You can look it for yourself. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 14 and 15 says, and no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. Ministers of righteousness. That means that they really think that by what they are doing, they actually do what? Or exercise what? Righteousness. And almost every secret society that was born from the time of the Garden of Eden, they always thought that their target is actually for good. It's actually for the best of humanity, for preserving of our planet. 2 Corinthians 4, 3-5 says, but even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose mind the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. You see, they chose their light. There's two lights. There is the real light, the good light, the light of the glory, the light of Christ, and there is the one who